You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Kevin Peters for the last 2 hours of diverse music and chat. But now, as the clock strikes noon, it's time for Bums on Seats. If you're new to the show, then we're just like the Oscars, though we pass judgment on films we've seen on the big screen rather than via watermark screeners squeezed in between business calls and power lunches. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Jenny Colley.
Hello.
Hannah Dunleavy.
Hello.
Gavin Midgley.
Hello.
And Owen Baker.
Hello.
Today's programme features three films adapted from three very different autobiographies. Leonardo DiCaprio is the Wolf of Wall Street in Martin Scorsese's ferocious portrayal of capitalism, Red in Tooth and Claw. The Railway Man stars Colin Firth in the true story of Ed Lomax, a Second World War radio operator who survived the Japanese prison camps only to be haunted by memories of the conditions he endured there. And after Hunger and Shame, Steve McQueen's third film, 12 Years a Slave, holds a mirror up to America's relatively recent horrific past, with Chiwetel Ejiofor as the born-free black man who suddenly finds himself reduced to being simple property. But we catch up with the Cambridge Film Consortium discussing the courses and workshops they've scheduled for the first few months of the year and what they think 2014 may hold in store for their popular archive screenings. And we dip into a piece recorded earlier this month for Julian Clover on 105 Drive, a chat with Neil McCartney from the Independent Film Trust and the Raindance Film Festival. But we begin by watching money make the world go round.
With this script, I'm going to teach each and every one of you to be the best.
This is the greatest company in the world!
I was becoming a legend.
Aren't you married?
Yeah, but married people can't have friends.
We're not going to be friends.
I was making so much money, I didn't know what to do with it.
$26,000 for one dinner!
Dad, we're not poor anymore.
Hang you up from the hill.
He's got pictures of your whole inner circle.
This is bad.
It's okay.
Rub my temple.
You're all right.
This right here is the land of opportunity.
You just tried to bribe a federal officer.
This is America.
This is my home!
Good for you, little man.
Me, the little man.
The show goes on. They're going to need to send in the National Guard to take me out because I ain't going nowhere.
Throughout his enormously significant career, critics have merrily informed Martin Scorsese what films he should or should not be making. After Hours, The Age of Innocence, Kundun, the Aviator, Cape Fear, none seem to fit the presumptuous notion of the director who had broken into the mainstream with the battle cry of Mean Streets. But after further perplexing his critics with the cine-literate fairy tale of Hugo, Scorsese is reassuringly back to dissecting the alpha male gangster type with his new release, The Wolf of Wall Street. Only this time the gangsters are of the white-collar variety. Working with Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire writer Terrence Winter, Scorsese has adapted the self-aggrandizing autobiography of Jordan Beaufort, a stocks trader who made it big enough to attract the attention of the FBI and whose money-making mantra is now parroted at conferences the world over. Leonardo DiCaprio plays Beaufort, a still wet behind the ears hopeful in a cheap suit when he arrives in the New York of the late 1980s. He quickly acclimatizes to the ruthlessness of working the stock market but loses everything in the 1987 crash. From boom to bust to boom, 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 Beaufort, accompanied by a typically slick Scorsese style and soundtrack, simply picks up the phone and begins earning millions again. Hannah, The Wolf of Wall Street is a mammoth undertaking. It's just shy of 3 hours. It's a full hour, full tilt satire of the American way in many respects. Were you swept up in Scorsese and DiCaprio's bravado?
Yes. I love giving the one-word answer. Yeah, I have to say it's fantastic. The opening 20 minutes are an absolute riot. I mean, funnier, far funnier than I think any comedy I've seen in years and years, which has most credit has to go to Matthew McConaughey, who is comes in right at the start and is absolutely hilarious. And Jonah Hill clearly carries a lot of the comedy as well. But yes, it's fantastic.
It's a lot of people have sort of critics have said, obviously, Scorsese has benchmarks that everybody sort of reaches for. Oh, it's another one of his gangster films. It's a bit like Casino. It's a bit like Goodfellas because it has that voiceover. It's a more like After Hours, which I know you haven't seen, but it's actually, when you get down to it, it's more about DiCaprio's playing the typical Scorsese outsider, whether it's Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver or King of Comedy or Ray Liotta or the fact that can't become a made man in Goodfellas because he's not of the right Italian stock. Yeah. He's dealing with those concerns again, really.
Well, he starts off as an outsider. I mean, obviously.
He remains an outsider all the way through. Because he says to the FBI, why aren't you dealing with the real crimes on Lehman Brothers? He remains an outsider.
But he does have his gang, which is increasingly grows and grows and grows.
But they never become more than the gang, noticeably, that he had when he was growing up. His friends remain his same friends. He never reaches outside that self-created clique. He. This is a very much a many. I'll bring Owen in on this. This is. I'll come back to you, Hannah. Don't worry. I'm keeping it fluid. This is in many respects. It's a film about many things, but it's about old money versus new money in many ways.
Yeah, I think it is to a large extent. I think that it is about that sort of, you know, he's made all this money and yet there is a degree to which he's striving for kind of acceptance and stuff. I think that absolutely is a sort of thread that runs through the film. I'm not sure that it. I think a lot of directors and a lot of films would have played that a lot stronger and a lot more obviously. I mean, he does mention it to the FBI agent and he does mention it a couple of other times as well. But I think it's hard to get away from the fact that this film is centrally really just about the morality of selling, of anything being for sale. Of, you know, I think this film's been criticised a bit, although it's been quite successful critically, it's been criticised a bit for lacking kind of judgment on this behaviour. I think that's unfair, just on an obvious level. I think it's pretty clear what it thinks of
it. It's been criticised for not giving the audience a judgment to accept.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you go in and you watch that and you think that's the sort of person I'd like to be, then
that's the sort of person you already are.
Yeah, exactly. But I think also I think it's really interesting because I think, although it's possible to argue that it doesn't give much of a judgment on Wall Street, but I think it gives a much greater judgment on society as a whole. That basically is saying everything is like this. There's a line at the end of the film or towards the end, which doesn't spoil it, where he says, "I realised I lived in a world where everything was for sale," and that I think really telling, because I think Scorsese's just saying to us, "Look, this is insane. Look what's going on here. Whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, it's mad." And everything's like this, or the whole world is like this. You know, the FBI are for sale, he's for sale, everything is just about selling. And I think it's a wonderful film. I think it's really good. And I think, just very quickly, I think if this DiCaprio's obviously got a bit of praise for his performance, but if this was a Daniel Day-Lewis performance, we'd be saying it was incredible. I think it's a really astonishing performance, and I think he carries a long film, you know, really
effortlessly.
And completely convincing.
And various different tempos. Mm. There is, as has been well documented, there's an extraordinary, Frank Tashlin, who used to direct Jerry Lewis films, amongst many other things, is an extraordinary Frank Tashlin-style scene later on where DiCaprio's trying to get into his car. Everybody's mentioned that scene. They don't mention the scene onwards from that where he's wrestling Jonah Hill in this drug-induced stupor.
It does get to a point where you think, am I watching Scorsese? Because this is so unbelievably slapstick, yes. I can't quite believe it.
I think you're watching the Scorsese that grew up with Frank Tashlin films and is referencing, not referencing that, but is pulling as he always has done. He pulls things from every part of his film upbringing. Hannah, many films that we review over the last few years have been American films that have tried to feel like they've tried to be the great American novel. This Wolf of Wall Street hasn't marketed itself like that. It's not based on that sort of book. But I felt it actually was held much more in the things it was saying about class and how the American class system works, I thought it was reaching to those levels, and it was going in similar areas to the great American television shows that I know you admire so much.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, if we're going to talk about television, we'll just briefly talk about Kyle Chandler, who is really brilliant in it, in a role which is quite... He has a wonderfully expressive face, and he has a great scene on the yacht with DiCaprio, which there is a callback to later, when he's later sitting on a train, which is utterly silent and exactly shows the point of class when he looks and sees who he's on a train with. And it's absolutely perfect.
He's the FBI agent. Yeah. And don't forget that that you get a suspicion that he's actually not the class he's now in. Because at the beginning of the scene where he goes to talk to DiCaprio, whose character he's not met yet, on the yacht, and DiCaprio says, "Have you been on one of these things before?" Showing off, like somebody showing off his fancy sports car, and he goes, "What, a boat? Yes, I learned to sail when I was 6. He's the waspish sort of character, the DiCaprio, but he's obviously not fallen, but he's taken a step downwards deliberately, and has accepted this.
Yeah, and he realizes that later in the film, I think,
that he could, because again, he could have been a broker himself. But I felt there's a long scene towards the end of the film where DiCaprio, who has, as Jordan Beaufort, has accepted a deal where, not the FBI deal, but a deal that would allow him to step away from the company, where he's giving one of his sales speeches, which is supposed to be his resignation, and it turns into the piece we hear in the trailer where they're going to have to call in the National Guard. And I was mesmerised by the shot Scorsese used of his brokers, these room full of young people, because they were all race, creed and colour. There's absolutely no prejudice or bigotry in any of Jordan Beaufort's world, in this world. If you sell well, you're accepted.
Not a huge amount of women, though.
No, but the women that they are... No, and they treat women as... They still treat people as objects, but I felt that... I tweeted last night that those shots of his brokers reminded me of the Ellis Island scenes in Godfather 2. There was every mix of...
Well, he does talk about Ellis Island, doesn't he?
That's true, yes.
This place is Ellis Island,
I didn't pick up on that, which now makes my tweet look like I was parroting the film and hoping nobody had seen the film. That's great. Well done.
Sorry.
No. I couldn't catch every word in a three-hour film. Again, I thought it was playing a lot more cards than just simply, oh, it's white-collar gangsters that the film's marketing.
I mean, you're right, those scenes are great, but I actually felt it did filter SAG a little bit in the middle, and I think that there was those scenes of him in the giving his speeches to his brokers, although fantastic, there were rather a lot of them. I actually liked it best when it was working on a one-to-one basis. There's a fantastic scene with him and Joanna Lumley, which is just perfect, just the two of them sitting on a bench. They're sort of, the one-on-one scenes are as good as the big, huge sort of set pieces. I mean, that when they were actually in the trading office and they were going through with the camera, to everyone, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Do you find it's unlike Scorsese's earlier films, the masterpieces like Raging Bull or After Hours,
which,
or Goodfellas, or Mean Streets, they have identifiable characters. Taxi Driver, they're characters that become iconic outside of their films. I can't quite see Jordan Beaufort there, because he remains a vacuum throughout the whole film. That's part of the point. This is a film of themes rather than of characters, and certainly not of story or plot.
Yeah, I think that's true. I want to stress again, the performance is extraordinary. So although I agree with you about the character, I think the performance is so good that I think it probably will stand the test of time. I agree, though, that the character... I mean, without wanting to be too sort of glib about it, I think basically it's a film about a psychopath and the enormous charisma that he carries. I mean, those scenes where the brokers are so obviously upset that he's going to leave, or, you know, the loss of him... I mean, they're a little cliched in a way, because it's kind of, oh, we can't be without you. But I think there's a sort of genuineness about that. And I think it's because of this. I mean, it is a film about a man with a lot of charisma, but the charisma is so superficial. I mean, because he has watered down the whole of his kind of world to the ability, like you said, to if you sell well, you're good. I mean, it does objectify women, but it objectifies everybody. I mean, everybody in this film is objectified,
including Beaufort, I would say. Women in an unreliable narrator sense. I know there's an article that Empire Online's put online this morning, which about how women are personified in this film, which I've not read yet, but I thought it was fascinating that they're always, with the exception of Beaufort's first wife, who we only briefly meet, who's from the same social standing as he is. He says she's a hairdresser, doesn't he, or something. They're always all the women in it are statuesque, and they're always framed in doorways.
Yeah.
It, when the first time there's two women in it, first time you see them, and they're completely naked, and they're framed in doorways. But that's how they. Yes, it's objectifying them, but it's also Beaufort elaborating the story in the way that you're
remembering it.
Remembering, and I think the unreliable narrator aspect actually comes more into play later in the film with the, when they're on the boat heading towards Europe and the plane explodes and you suddenly realise, hang on, have we started this?
Yeah,
it's starting to spiral out of control as his drug taking spirals out of control. Do you think, Hannah, the people that one of the problems some people have had with this, and I can imagine in the screenings it enjoys the next few weeks in Cambridge, people will have with this, is the repetition of it. I felt it was deliberately repeating a lot of, as you said, he gives more than one speech. The repetition is the deliberately deadening of the joyful experiences they're having. They're constantly partying, they're constantly having sex, they're constantly taking drugs. They don't seem to enjoy any of it. And in the end, the film sort of, not really. And they're men and women with no hobbies, no interests outside this little world they're in. I felt the film repeated itself in order to underline how deadening the experience is.
I mean, to be honest, that's what I've assumed that people like that are like anyway. Yeah, to be honest. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of joy in it, except in the acquisition of money. But that I think we're well established that to work in that sort of industry, that has to be what motivates.
It's not the acquisition of money. Even as Rob Reiner, who plays DiCaprio's father, says later on, you don't need more money. Do you want the world's money? And I don't think DiCaprio's character does. It's just simply playing the game and winning. It's not actually the acquisition of wealth.
But that is the acquisition of wealth, isn't it?
Wealth to buy anything. He doesn't do anything with it.
But that's how they judge each other, by how much money they make. McConaughey gives that speech at the start about how what's real money and what's not actually real money. It's the ability to remind people exactly how much you are earning at any point. It's not necessarily the money that you have that's available to spend.
Did you want more? A little bit. Final point. I know the film deliberately doesn't show any context in terms of what their money making schemes, their shareholding schemes, especially with the penny shares they're working at the beginning, the actual effect it had on real people. It deliberately doesn't go there because, again, that wouldn't be Beaufort's point of view.
Although his first wife does actually.
His first wife does point it out. And again, it's not the film's job to have a conscience for everybody watching it. But did you need a little bit, perhaps, more of what drove Beaufort? I thought it was interesting in the big speech where he's about to resign and he says, actually, he realises, I've never said no, I've never backed away from anything in my life, and if I do now, I'm going to be playing their game. And that moment reminded me of what Adam Curtis, a documentarian, has said about Rupert Murdoch, who's a different sort of character, but the fact that they're driven not by the acquisition of wealth, but driven by being left out of the party. and that struck a chord, that there was another level to Beaufort here that the film doesn't explore, it just hints at.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, to be honest, I was slightly not concerned, but I mean, the actual practicalities of how it worked interest me. And there was a couple of times in which he attempts to explain it and then says, "No, I'm not going to bother," because obviously it's complicated or boring, etc., and you don't know. And that actually doesn't particularly matter, that you don't actually kind of understand what they're up to. But I suppose the only thing that slightly confused me was the time frame. There was a point in which I thought they'd leapt further forward in time, largely because they used songs that hadn't been released yet. Mm. And then it turned out that we were actually still only in the early 90s. And then I thought, oh, that probably explains why they haven't been chasing him before now, because it hasn't actually been the long, protracted thing that it seems. So
No, they introduced the FBI about 20, 25 minutes into the film and then forgets them for another hour and a half.
Yeah, and you do wonder why.
I think, to be fair, though, that's one of the most shocking things in the film, to some extent, though, how quickly, how short a span of time he does all this in.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right that you do get about two-thirds of the way through the film and go, blimey, is that only that long ago?
Yeah.
You know, but it is itself shocking that he's able to do this so quickly just because he's just so successful. And I thought it was great. I really, really enjoyed it.
I just realised I didn't answer your question. So.
That's okay. That's all right.
I was just pleased
you managed more than two words in response. That's okay. Okay, well, The Wolf of Wall Street opened yesterday and is screening at the Arts Picture House, as well as both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. Festooned with nudity and laced with an awful lot of bad language, it is a thoroughly deserved Certificate 18. When the announcement was made late last year that the Cambridge Arts Picture House might have to be sold due to Cineworld having one too many cinemas in the city, the focus was understandably on the possible loss of truly diverse film programming. But many other activities and concerns run out of the cinema on St Andrew Street. Buried away in an office that nestles cheek by jowl with the back of screen 3 is the Cambridge Film Consortium, which since 1999 and in partnership with ARU, City Screen Limited, Parkside Federation and Long Road Sixth Form College has been delivering a stream of increasingly important educational and filmmaking events. The consortium has a busy 2014 on the horizon with archive screenings and workshops already lined up or being arranged. I spoke to the consortium's director, Trish Scheel, about the upcoming archive screenings and courses planned, but I began by asking for details on the three courses on Spanish film, Chinese cinema and Japan's Studio Ghibli planned for the next couple of months.
Course we run, we do a feedback form, and at the end of the feedback form we'll ask people, what would you like in future courses? And I remember them, so what I do is I have a look and I think, oh right, oh, that's an interesting one. And then as I sort of come into contact with people, it might be in the film festival, it might be through people that I know maybe doing research at the university, then I think I'll match the ideas of what people want with the people that I'm meeting. The way the courses came about this year, for the beginning of this year, the Spanish cinema came about through a postgraduate student who's interested in Spanish and Catalan culture, doing a PhD in it at Cambridge University, and has worked with us before, worked in the Cambridge Film Consortium, knew very much about the type of work that I do. We came up with this course on Spanish, Catalan, Basque cinema. So, I mean, it's going to be very interesting because it's going to be unusual. Because we want to put a screening of Black Bread into it, which was shown at the Cambridge Film Festival. The tutor for Chinese cinema is a regular tutor. And again, what we do is we have a look what the requests are. And then Philip Lloyd, his name is, and he said he would be interested in teaching Chinese because he's very interested in Asian culture and Asian cinema. So he's going to do the Chinese cinema course. The Studio Ghibli is a new one for us, and this one is coming through our links with Picture House Cinemas in Hackney. They've run this course as an evening course, and we're trying it out as a Sunday, on a one-day course on a Sunday. And it's been very popular in London, so we're hoping it's going to be popular here.
What shape do the courses take? As you say, the Chinese cinema is a vast, vast subject, and it's... It's even larger on this course because it includes Hong Kong and it includes Taiwanese. That's just about a month. Is it once a week? And how academic is it? You don't get a qualification at the end, do you? So it really is just answering curiosity, which is obviously no bad thing.
The underlying principle of the courses is it's learning for learning's sake and it's teaching for teaching's sake. So there are no connections at all to any organisation which requires reporting or, you know, exams or anything like that. And because of that, we then really work with the passions of the tutors and the interests of the tutors. And I think that's really important because that's what really distinguishes the courses, is that the audiences, the people who attend, the participants, really feed off the enthusiasm of the tutors. The type of audience we get is a regular set of people. We've got a group who come to a lot of our courses, and we email them out each term and let them know what the new courses are. And then we have new people, depending on the way, you know, like obviously on the topic, you'll get somebody maybe who's not been before but really interested in that particular topic and then might start coming to more courses. The level, I would describe the level of the courses, is informed and informal. The important thing is most of the people who come to the courses are working, and the principle isn't that you're heading towards an academic career, it's that you love film and that you love some area of film, but you want a deeper knowledge. The tutors are very informed, but the idea is that it's accessible. So the whole principle is that you know, you might come in tired at the end of a day's work and you should go out invigorated. So the level is probably about first year undergraduate, is how I would describe it. So it's sort of stimulating, but at the same time, not so esoteric that you would feel uncomfortable with it. And the other thing about the courses is that we do encourage group discussion. It's important that people engage in this, and that maybe from the courses people will then become film goers together.
Hi, my name's Jack and I'm the education assistant for the Cambridgeshire Film Consortium and also the marketing manager for the Cambridge Arts Picture House. By doing these two roles, and I don't normally use this word on radio, but it's created a bit of a synergy. I think I can say the word synergy in marketing terms between Picture House and CSC. So I can one day be having a film education hat on top of my head, but then thinking a bit about marketing, and then the other day I can have a marketing hat on, but thinking, hey, this would be brilliant for the film education aspect in Cambridge. Alternative content has become far more in vogue, and film education can often fall into the alternative content bracket. So if you've got an audience that are coming in for a lunchtime encore screening of a national theatre programme, there is absolutely no reason why you now can't include a film education programme around that. And the same applies on weekends. People are more willing to come to the cinema, not just to see a film, but to learn about a film, to discuss a film in the bar afterwards. And that grows every year as we have more and more people attending our courses.
So what is it you're currently engaged in doing?
I've just finished the first draft of the latest archive show's programme notes, and this is a nice new four-page spread that we give to all the audience members that come along on a Wednesday afternoon for these archive shows. And in terms of audience development, we've been focusing on the north of the city, as Trish has said. So for kids and teenagers, CB4 is the area, but really, we're getting more access to Cambridge Central Library as well through the BFI Media Tech, and I believe a chap from there is going to be coming along to our archive shows as well to talk a bit about what they offer, so we're trying to build up relationships there as well.
The approach that Jack in the office is taking now with the marketing, it's actually building up now, our audiences are building, because we're linking a lot more closely into the Picture House's marketing approach. But the general archive shows, which the consortium sets up, run on Wednesday lunchtimes, and audiences for that are regular. They're regular audiences with individuals coming in when they see an area of interest. And we plan this year to... we've got the first three set up for February, where we're looking at Homefront Britain. In March, we're looking at Children of the Second World War. And in April, we're looking at growing up in a post-war Britain. And audiences really seem to enjoy those screenings. So those films we continue with. But as you say, with the centenary of the First World War coming up, we will certainly looking probably, because it starts about August, but we'll probably start in the September, October, start looking at a season of films linked in to the First World War. And what I really would like to do is find some regional archive material around this region, East Anglia, around the archives films for that. The other interesting project is the Tour de France is coming through Cambridge, and we're going to be looking at July for a special programme for archive films, either with the consortium or through the Trust, on looking at cycling and, you know, through the archives, which I think would be really fantastic.
I would imagine you'd be happy to have partners and schools and people come aboard for those things.
What we'll be doing is talking hopefully to the history teachers about the way they're teaching the First World War and looking at where film can supplement and support that. It's a project that we've got to develop. We've got 4 years. I mean, it's only beginning in August. It runs for 4 years. So we know, for example, the Imperial War Museum will be putting out scores for two new films probably around about 2016. So it's an ongoing project, and we would love to work with partners, you know. So if any school or college or any group, history group, are interested in talking to us, we'd be delighted to look at, you know, joint projects on that, and then look at the way film can support and enhance that.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Trish Hill and Jack Toy for finding time during the last week for an interview. A longer version of the piece will be available when this show goes out as a Cambridge 105 podcast later in the week, whilst the second part will be broadcast on our next live show in 2 weeks' time. That part, which includes an interview with local filmmaker Rid Cook, will discuss the changing landscape of film education in the UK, with a consortium among the many groups introducing the new Film Academy courses begun last year by the BFI. You can find out more about the work of the consortium and the upcoming courses on Spanish cinema, Chinese cinema and the films of Studio Ghibli, all which have started in the next few weeks, by visiting their website, www.cambridgefilmconsortium.org, or by checking out the consortium posters that now adorn the cinema walls, show before each film at the Picture House, and maybe be found at FOP, as well as other locations.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
As ever, please don't forget there's still lots to come after we finish up at 1pm. Following on after us will be the music and chat of Saturday Lunch, followed at 2pm by the wonderful Arts Roundup, and then at 3pm by everything both Cambridge and Italian in Radio Dante. 105 Sport is from 4pm with updates from the Cambridge United away match to Halifax Town. But we've still got half an hour of the show to go, including a talk with Neil McCartney of the Independent Film Trust and a review of Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave. But before all of that, we're trying to forget the war.
Well, I'd never been to the Highlands before.
It's very romantic. You're romantic?
He's a wonderful man. I've seen it. But he's a mess. I want to know what happened to Eric. I don't believe in this code of silence that you have.
War leaves a mark. He's alive. He's alive. And I know where he is. He won't have a clue you're coming.
This is what you're going to do, isn't it?
I'm afraid the museum is closed.
I'm surprised you don't recognize me. So, Max.
I am asking the questions you answer.
I did not expect you to be alive. No! What happened in that room? Did they do to you?
The remarkable true story of Second World War veteran Eric Lomax has proved compelling enough for three adaptations: a TV drama starring John Hurt, an award-winning documentary entitled Enemy, My Friend, and now star-studded new cinema release The Railway Man. Adapted from Lomax's memoir by Frank Crottrell Boyce, the film stars Colin Firth as the middle-aged Lomax, an unassuming man governed by the timetables and order of the British railway system. His one impulsive moment is the act of true love that finds him chasing and winning the hand of Nicole Kidman's gently flirtatious divorcee, Patty. But Lomax's mild exterior masks a shattered mind. After marriage, Patty discovers her husband is plagued by nightmares and waking dreams of his time 35 years ago when imprisoned by the Japanese army. Caught up in the humiliating surrender as the Japanese swept through Singapore, Lomax found himself assigned to the Railway of Death, the infamous line between Bangkok and Rangoon. Here he joined a chain gang of other POWs cutting away the jungle and the mountains to build a railway in impossible and inhumane conditions. Gavin, The Railway Man has much to recommend it, a surprisingly little documented episode of the Second World War, fine actors in relatively unshowy roles, a good scriptwriter working from a compelling story. Is the final film the sum of these distinguished parts?
I'm still trying to decide, I have to say. It's got a lot of problems. See, Jenny agrees with me. It's got a lot of problems, and there's a lot of good ingredients that have gone into the film. And so you can feel that there's a lot of well-intentioned, sort of well-qualified ingredients have gone into this product, but the end result is disappointing. But at the same time, parts of it do work, and I'm sort of torn between the good parts and the not so good parts as to whether I actually liked it in the end. I think the story's interesting in itself, obviously, which does go a long way to helping it make it watchable. But there's, in terms of technical technical review, I can't say it's actually a really good film. No.
Jenny, it is an interesting story, and it raises interesting issues. But is part of the problem here that it never seems to find its centre? It drifts between not present day, but present day in the time of the film, the 1980s, and 35 years older in the Japanese prisoner of war camps. And it doesn't really seem to find a character to follow, an emotion to follow. It's a sort of falls a bit betwixt and between.
I think that's a fairly accurate summary of one of its many, many problems. I think, you know, you've said it's an interesting story, and I think the film somehow manages to miss that. So I'm sure if I were to go away and read up on this, I would be interested, but whilst watching the movie, I was not interested. I didn't think that what they were showing on screen was remotely compelling. I didn't think it was even logical. You know, you had Nicole Kidman's character saying, "My husband's a wonderful man," but you had no actual evidence for that in the build-up of their relationship. They had a chat on a train, they got married, and then he became really quite nasty towards her. You know, he completely shut her out and became cold and vicious. And you were thinking, but why do you think he's a nice man? We've not seen this side of him. You're being told constantly he's honourable, he's brave, he's powerful. And you're like, I haven't seen any of this in either the flashbacks or the present day. And that's the problem with the movie, is you're constantly being told, this is interesting, this is powerful, this is compelling and distressing. But none of that is on the screen. And so it just becomes very boring and pointless.
I mean, narratively, it is a mess. Certainly in the first half, it's all over the place. And our sympathies aren't really with anyone to begin with, because he keeps chopping and changing, flashing forward and back. And we're never quite sure. It never hits the tone. It never finds the tone of the story it's trying to find. And so unless you make it past that first half, which clearly Jenny wasn't, I think, yeah, it loses you. I thought
screen.
By the end it had found its footing. It had found a sort of tone that it wanted. And you know, it was quite moving, the final sort of ending. I thought
I didn't find it too moving, because it had cheated to get us there. The end of the film finds him, which is what the documentary My Enemy, My Friend, question mark, in that he finds him reunited with a Japanese translator who was present at all that when his younger self was being tortured for harbouring a radio. He has no reason to trust this Japanese translator. The film softens the blow by giving us shots that Colin Firth's character couldn't have had of the translator looking uncomfortable during these sessions of waterboarding. It constantly dilutes what the film's about in order to make it middlebrow. I think that's where the problem lies. That's why any of it doesn't really hit hard. It's constantly hedging its bets and playing it safe.
No, I mean, I didn't feel that quite so much. I thought it was never quite certain what role the Japanese character was playing throughout. I mean, whether he was just an interpreter or whether he was actually more instrumental in what was going on at the camp is never made absolutely explicit. But I don't think that was the point. I think the point was that he was obviously involved to some extent. To what extent, we don't know, but he still felt guilty for his part in that. And so, as a result, I still found that there was still an emotional connection there. But it was just a struggle through the editing of the film and, as you say, the sort of the performances, which some were better than others, shall we say. I thought Colin Firth was good, but Stellan Skarsgård was probably a bit out of place. In fact, if they dropped his character altogether, it would
then
have
he wouldn't have had an impetus
to
go back to Japan, because it completely ditches everything his wife Patty, Nicole Kidman's character, is doing to try to get him to open up about his experiences. It has a fairly interesting story, an unusual story in that Jenny's right, we don't see enough of their marriage before his nightmares attack him, but the idea that her affection is what's going to help break him out of this cycle is completely ruined by having this other character come in and say, well, actually, I'll help, and then he can't help, so he hangs himself in order to make him feel so guilty, Colin Firth's character so guilty, that he'll go back to Japan.
But it sort of muddies the narrative as well.
Exactly.
He starts telling it in the flashback, and then obviously he gets dropped, and it's all over. It's a bit messy, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll end this so we have more time on the far less messy, the far, far, far better 12 years a slave, sorry. The Railway Man opened last weekend and is screened at Cambridge Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bumps on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio today are Jenny Colley, Hannah Dunleavy, Gavin Midgley and Owen Baker. Just before Christmas, Cambridge 105's Drive Time show played host to Neil McCartney, chairman of the Independent Film Trust and a regular on many Cambridge filmmaking groups and courses. Neil came into Cambridge 105 to speak to Julian Clover on 105 Drive. They spoke about the uniqueness, the art, and the artful solution Neil had come up with for the Rain Dance's prizes for the Rain Dance Independent Film Festival, as well as finding family, a new, very personal film from Cambridge director Augie Tomic. But to begin with, Julian asked Neil about the idea behind the Rain Dance Independent Film Awards.
Rain Dance is the largest festival of independent filmmaking in Europe. It's been running for just over 20 years. This year was the 21st edition. When I say the largest festival, I mean in terms of number of submissions and the number of films screened. This year we got about 4,300 submissions from around the world. Half of them features, half of them shorts. We screened 127 features and about more than 150 shorts from 51 countries. Runs over 10 days. We sold about 15,000 tickets and distributed 10,000 printed programmes. And we've never had a penny of public money. It's a great platform for films because last two or three years, generally speaking, about half of the features that we show, I mean, everything we show has to be at least a UK premiere. So no public screening before that. And about half of the features get picked up for commercial release. Mm. So it is a great platform for filmmakers. It does generate a lot of activity.
And some awards ran alongside the film festival, and you were using some Cambridge artists, I believe, in order to create those awards.
Rain Dance has had awards almost from the start. You know, there's an award for best British feature, there's an award for best British short, and so on. But up until now, what you get is that you get the prize, but you just get a certificate and a handshake and the glory. No. But no actual
photograph of the local paper, that sort of thing.
No actual physical gong. And, of course, going back to what we previously discussed, there's no budget for this, there's no money, that's why there's never been any. So I came up with the idea of, why don't we ask some creative artist to create original artworks, ask them to contribute them to us, and in return give them publicity through the various outlets to which we have access. What I ended up with was actually six artists who between them contributed 10 awards.
So I'm assuming that instead of having one single design, you ended up with lots of different ones.
No, the original artworks. Mm. So the artists that we ended up using, the three from Cambridge, Lucas Morley, Susie Oksak, and Hannah Clarkson. So Susie Oksak did two in limestone, and they went to the best foreign feature and the best foreign short. Best animated short, that was by Hannah, did that one. Best debut feature, that was the one Lucas Morley did. Actually, that was a really nice. It was a carved block of wood made out of black walnut. So that's what that sort of works, because I didn't want to either have like a single design or a single medium, because after all, it's a range of things. Next year we could do, something different.
The other thing I'd like to talk to you about is the movie Finding Family, which you've also been involved with to a certain extent.
Well, Finding Family is made by a Cambridge-based friend of mine called Augie Tomic, who is originally from Bosnia. And he was born in Sarajevo and abandoned virtually at birth and suffered from a number of problems, lived through the civil wars of the former Yugoslavia, came to the UK, established himself as a filmmaker, is now a successful commercial filmmaker, and he decided to make a film about trying to find his family. And the film is his story about going back to Sarajevo to try and establish a connection with these people. And it turns out that his family are Serbs. So they were the same nationality as the people who were bombing and shelling him in Sarajevo throughout more than 1,000 days of war.
I guess that's quite
about that emotional wrench.
Yes,
he discovers that
very difficult.
Yeah.
But it looks like it's made for an interesting film. Is there any chance this might be shown in Cambridge at some point?
Oh, yes, yes. It's the film was premiered at the Sarajevo Film Festival last August and got a standing ovation on both occasions it was shown. It was also shown at the View Cinema in Leicester Square. It was at a charity event, fundraising for a homeless charity. That event was attended by people like Kristen Scott Thomas, the actress. We'd like to show it in Cambridge, and I've approached a number of potential venues, and I think almost certainly we'll be showing it at least twice in the in the new year, between the new year and Easter, and probably at college venues. Provisional arrangements with Queen's and Magdalen to show them at both places.
Okay,
and I think it would get, you know, there's a lot of people who want to come and see it, it'd get a good audience, and. And to have the filmmaker there to talk about it, and he lives here.
No, absolutely. Interesting, these personal stories. There's always, yes. always something about them. It just adds
Well, there's something
dynamic
about having the filmmaker there to actually talk about why did they do that? Why did they? Why that shot rather than that? What drove them to it? What made them think? You know, that's really, you don't get from just going, you're going and seeing a film, but it can be a great experience in itself. But then actually getting into the mind of the director is what really adds value.
No, very much so. So sometime in the new year, and let us know absolutely as to when it's going to be shown, and then we can let everybody else know as well. Neil, thank you very much indeed
pleasure,
for coming.
Pleasure. Oh, yeah, thank you very much.
Neil McCartney, Chairman of the Independent Film Trust.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Gillian Clover for allowing me to access and shorten his interview just before Christmas. You may find the whole thing, which runs to about 12 minutes, on the podcast page of the Cambridge 105 website, www.cambridge105.fm. And you can find out more about Raindance by visiting their new website, www.raindance.org. The site has just started taking submissions for 2014. The last 12 months has seen America's slavery history dealt with both by Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's political power play, and Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's heavily spiced exploitation western. New release 12 Years a Slave now completes an accidental and unlikely trilogy, but this time the hard truth doesn't find itself diluted by prestige picture theatrics or blood-soaked homage. Instead, 12 Years a Slave, director Steve McQueen's third film after Hunger and Shame, is an unflinching look into America's heart of darkness. Adapted by John Ridley in a manner that keeps the sing-song cadence of mid-19th century English, McQueen's film manages the balancing act of depicting the detail and texture of the period without relaxing into it. Chiwetel Ejiofor plays Solomon Northrup, a born free Negro living in New York, well north of the Mason-Dixie line. An accomplished musician and engineer, he and his wife live a well-to-do life, greeted in the street as a minor celebrity and welcomed into all the best uptown stores. Then one day he's kidnapped, beaten, shackled and shipped south to New Orleans. Given the identity of a runaway slave, he finds his old life slipping away as he's sold back. He's sold into a market he thought he'd never have to experience. Jenny, I'm going to come straight to you rather than go to the trailer so we have a bit more time. Mm-hmm. In interviews supporting 12 Years a Slave, Steve McQueen has stressed that he always wanted to make a film about American slavery, but wanted a fresh approach to it, a sort of a new perspective. Do you think he's found that with the central character of Solomon Northrup?
I would say so, yes. I think that, you know, I had quite a theoretical understanding of how horrific slavery was, and having seen Django Unchained, I think I did have quite a good idea of how visceral it could be, but this movie I felt opened my eyes to a degree that I didn't think was even possible, of just how soul destroying and consistently barbaric it must have been for those people. I was just transfixed from beginning to end with this movie. It was genuinely very distressing and very interesting, and just lots of other kind of positive words for such a horrible subject matter. I thought it was fascinating.
Gavin, it's actually, it's interesting. It's again, completely accidentally, like Lincoln, which doesn't really deal with slavery, but it deals with politics, and Django Unchained, which obviously, whilst it's a genuinely angry film, slavery's almost more the setting, but they all find a context where slavery doesn't exist in some parts of America, where you can hold it up against something and say, look, we are changing, and that makes this even, not more horrible, but it shows the hardness up even clearer. This 12 Years a Slave is extremely good at that. That's the unusual approach that Steve McQueen's found, of being able to go from a world where a born free black man is it can walk in the street to one where he's just property simply by a ship journey.
Yeah, and it shows the divisions that already existed, as you say, in different parts of the United States. So in the South, it's still, people are brought up believing it's their, God-given right to own slaves. It's not even a question that enters their mind. The choice of the different masters, so as the film progresses, Solomon Northrup obviously moves from master to master, and the range of attitudes at the time, that existed at the time, are quite colourfully illustrated in each of the different masters. So you've got Benedict Cumberbatch as quite a seemingly nice sort
benevolent,
of guy.
Yeah.
Benevolent, yeah. He treats his slaves like people. He talks to them. He gives them gifts. But he never once questions his belief to his right to own slaves, and never once sort of questions the moral responsibility that comes with it. And then, of course, he moved to Michael Fassbender's master, who's fervently believes in his right, his divine right to have slaves, and the economic benefits that come with them, because obviously underpinning all this is the enormous sort of economic essential, sort of the essential aspect of slavery to the economy. You know, they couldn't conceive of a future without it. So that's, and then of course towards the end, Brad Pitt's character emerges, who's very much the sort of enlightened modern character who has sort of lives in, has seen parts of the country where it doesn't exist. So you've got a sort of full range, full spectrum of attitudes. So it's very, it sort of beautifully illustrates what the attitudes were at the time, and where the sort of thought and opinion was moving towards, and obviously resulting in the Civil War a few years later.
Hannah, this is very much, obviously, it's based from Solomon Northrup's book, so it's very much his story. But do you feel, like I felt, and we discussed this and after we saw the film, whether the film gets too carried away with Michael Fassbender's character? This is the third time that Steve McQueen's worked with this actor, and the film, and in an interview, Steve McQueen is fascinated with Epps, with this self-hatred, this brew of self-hatred and racism and bullying, and I felt the film sort of got taken away from Chiwetel a little bit and became his story, and that was, whilst interesting, wasn't what the film was about. Do you think that's fair?
I don't know. I mean, I have Shame and Hunger. I mean, even though in Hunger, Fassbender's playing Bobby Sands, so he's an established character, even so, Fassbender remains sort of a unknown cipher in both films, and he manages to do that in this as well. But since he's not the central character, I feel like it works better, because there are other characters that you can look at and you can actually see their thinking. You sort of see Fassbender thinking, but you never know what's going on inside his head, particularly. So that worked quite well. Something Jenny said, I mean, I actually thought it was less brutal than I was expecting.
Yes.
Because there's the sort of forensic eye that Steve McQueen has applied to every other subject matter that he's got involved with. I was expecting something worse than this. I was expecting more detail, more gore. And in fact, I came away from it thinking that it wasn't quite as gut-wrenching as I expected it to be.
Can I clarify what I meant by the brutality, actually, because I picked up on a point there, that for me the brutality was very emotional. So there were two points in the film that made me cry, and there was one where a slave owner said to a slave, "You brought this on yourself,"
yeah,
and then starts whipping her, and I found that extremely distressing.
Yeah.
Not so much the actual whipping, although that was distressing, but this idea that she had done
yeah.
something to deserve it.
Yeah.
I found that really upsetting.
Yeah.
This is what this film does do is it gets across what other films perhaps of this type haven't done, is it gets across the idea very, very strongly that these aren't people. They are simply
yeah.
property, and you can treat them in any
yeah.
way.
And I think the other point I thought that you were just discussing earlier about how it shows that there were various degrees of enlightenment sort of across the country.
Seems the further north you get, the nicer it is.
The nicer you get. There is one scene in which I think sort of plays as some slight reminder that's actually is no matter how enlightened people were, it didn't, is when the slaves encounter a group of Native American Indians, and it's very short, but it does remind you that wasn't the views of, and perhaps the views and how enlightened people were perhaps weren't as enlightened as perhaps they appear to
it
be.
Wasn't
because
a
there was another was another battle going on there, and there were another group of people who also weren't being treated like that they were human beings. And they encounter each other very quickly for a small moment, and they are sort of united in for a very small moment, and perhaps it demonstrates that. Or I don't know if it was deliberate when McQueen put it in there, or it comes from the, if it comes from the material. But it perhaps reminds you that that even the more enlightened people in the country were perhaps as enlightened as they were making out themselves to be,
or didn't see any other reason to be enlightened. They thought enlightenment ended with this decision.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything else.
Yeah.
I think that that complexity of racism is something the film dances around but doesn't quite deal with. I think as a final point, I'll come to Jenny to finish up, is that I felt it let itself down a little bit by, and the reason why I brought Fassbender up is by portraying such an by focusing on such an unpleasant man who would have been unpleasant without, even if he hadn't been a racist. It deals with it with the exception of Benedict Cumberbatch's Ford. It just gives us racists that are unpleasant people no matter who they're around, and it gives racism a little bit of an out. It gives America a little bit of an out. It says, well, these were unpleasant people and these people don't exist. I thought that simplified it. I would have rather had more about Benedict Cumberbatch's character, where racism sat side by side with benevolence rather than side by side with bullying.
Yeah, I think the niceness of Cumberbatch's character was almost more vicious because, you know, as Gavin's saying, it was difficult to watch him be nice and not care at the same time. I think if the idea of racism had been explored much more deeply, it would have been a really long film, though. I thought it was more interesting and more enlightened than almost any other film I've seen in quite a long time. So, you know, I agree with you, but I think it's kind of a passing criticism that you're making.
I wonder whether that's because it was made by someone who's not an American.
That's a possibility. Okay, all right, well, we have to end on that huge note.
Yeah.
We'll end it anyway. Okay, 12 Years a Slave opened last weekend, is showing at both View and Cineworld multiplexes, as well as the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 15. We'll wrap up there. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time on the 2nd of February. Mark Liversidge will be taking a turn in the hosting chair. There'll be Lone Survivor, Inside Llewellyn Davis, Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, and a little bit more from the Cambridge Film Consortium. Quick bit of listings this coming Tuesday, January the 21st. We'll see film academic Patrick Fowler visit Cambridge to discuss the early 1980s cinema of Derek Jarman and his contemporaries. So we'll play out with some of Simon Fisher-Turner's score for Jarman's Caravaggio. Please stay tuned for Saturday Lunch, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.